Samuel chapter 18. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return to his father's house. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow and his belt. Whatever Saul sent him to do, David did so successfully. So successfully that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the people and Saul's officers as well. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel and met with King Saul, with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with tambourines and lutes. As they danced, they sang, "Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands." Saul was very angry. This refrain galled him. "They have credited David with tens of thousands," he thought, "but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom?" And from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. The next day, an evil spirit from God came forcefully upon Saul. He was prophesying in his house while David was playing the harp, as he usually did. Saul had a spear in his hand, and he hurled it, saying to himself, "I'll pin David to the wall." But David eluded him twice. Saul was afraid of David, because the Lord was with David, but he had left Saul. So he sent David away from him and gave him command over 1,000 men, and David led the troops in their campaigns. In everything he did, he had great success, because the Lord was with him. When Saul saw how successful he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he led them in their campaigns. Saul said to David, "Here is my older daughter, Merab. I will give her to you in marriage. Only serve me bravely and fight the battles of the Lord." For Saul said to himself, "I will not raise a hand against him. Let the Philistines do that." But David said to Saul, "Who am I, and what is my family or my father's clan in Israel, that I should become the king's son-in-law?" So when the time came for Merab, Saul's daughter, to be given to David, she was given in marriage to Adriel of Meroah. Now Saul's daughter, Michal, was in love with David, and when they told Saul about it, he was pleased. "I will give her to him," he thought, "so that she may be a snare to him, and so that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." So Saul said to David, "Now that you have a second opportunity to become my son-in-law." Then David ordered his attendants, then Saul ordered his attendants, "Speak to David privately and say, 'Look, the king is pleased with you and his attendants all like you. Now become his son-in-law.'" They repeated these words to David, but David said, "Do you think it is a small matter to become the king's son-in-law? I am only a poor man and little known." When Saul's servants told him that what David had said, Saul replied, "Say to David, 'The king wants no other price for the bride than 100 Philistine foreskins to take revenge on his enemies.'" Saul's plan was to have David fall by the hands of the Philistines. When the attendants told David these things, he was pleased to become the king's son-in-law. So before the allotted time elapsed, David and his men went out and killed 200 Philistines. He brought their foreskins and presented the full number to the king so that he might become the king's son-in-law. Then Saul gave him his daughter, Michal, in marriage. When Saul realized that the Lord was with David and that his daughter, Michal, loved David, Saul became still more afraid of him, and he remained his enemy for the rest of his days. The Philistine commanders continued to go out to battle, and as often as they did, David met with more success than the rest of Saul's officers, and his name became well known. Thank you, Rob.
The buzzing is me, by the way. Every time I switch my microphone on, it buzzes. So don't blame anybody else, it's me. I must be picking up electromagnetic forces or something. It's great to be with you. Thank you for this opportunity of being here three Sundays in succession. Let me just remind you what we're looking at, and then we'll begin our two-part event for today. We're looking at the theme, Getting the King Out of the Boy. In other words, here is a shepherd boy, David, who becomes, from a human point of view, the greatest king that Israel ever had. And we are looking at the process that God put him through, and some of the things he had to learn. Many of them were quite difficult, in order to become the best version of himself. And we looked in our first week together at the fact that David has a crystal clear view of what God's program for him is. I wonder if you do. And we looked at how that became clear to David. We explored some of the forgotten principles of guidance. And then last week, we had a look at a key player stepping up. And we looked at some of the problems and pressures that were on David. And we looked at how he didn't respond to them. And we looked at how he did respond to them. What we're going to look at today is this fascinating insight into the nightmare that David was living with. And we're going to look at how God supported him through the nightmare. Now, I need to give you a public health warning, and that is that this morning is very much analytical, theoretical. We're just going to be looking at the Bible, lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of verses. So it's not goosebumps, it's not devotional, it's not application. So if you lose the will to live this morning and feel like sleeping, that's okay. I don't mind. I really don't. As long as you don't snore, okay? Tonight is the application. Tonight is the, well, how on earth does this work out in practice? So I wanted to look at the level to which David steps up in this chapter, because I think it's so easy to read these words in the Bible and not imagine what that would be like in November 2012. I want us just to use a bit of creative imagination and imagine that this was happening to somebody in our culture today, so that we kind of move aside the veil of, oh, I know this, I've read it 1,000 times, to, wow, that is what was happening. I remember in 2009, listening to Kate Winslet, who I think is a brilliant actress, giving her speech when she received an Oscar for a film that she'd starred in. And it was really moving because she said, when I was a little girl of 8, I used to stand in my bedroom holding a shampoo bottle as a microphone and imagining I was giving this speech when I received my Oscar. I thought that was lovely. And I thought to myself, I wonder when she got the Oscar, and now she's arrived at that profile in terms of being an actress, whether it felt like she imagined it would feel like when she was a little girl. Because I think that many of us in our heart want to be used by God. We want to be sold out to Jesus. We want to be moving in what he has for us in our life. And maybe we imagine what that would be like and what that would feel like and look like. And my instinct is that it would probably feel a lot different than we imagine it would. And it's almost as though in David's life we have a spotlight and God is saying, look, the level to which David stepped up is way out of your league, Rob. And I would suspect way out of everybody's league here. But the stuff that happened to him when he was at that level is going to be put in sharp focus so that you can see what it's like if you stepped up a level in terms of being available to God. So I wanted to look at two things this morning. And I'll give you the first one in a moment. I just wanted to say that one of the things I share with our students is, if you want to get God's emphasis from a passage of scripture, rather than importing into that passage ideas that you think should be there, or going off down my favourite side path or riding my own hobby horse when I see a passage of scripture, if I want to get the message that God has for me, one of the best things I can do is look for recurring words in that passage. You know, if God's trying to say something to us, he can turn the volume up or he can keep repeating himself. And many passages of scripture, if you get a little highlighter and you look for words that keep recurring and you shade them through, you're suddenly amazed at how often that word appears in the passage. And my take on that is that that is the thrust of the passage. That's the main thing that God is seeking to say through that passage. So I want to read some verses that we just listened to and see if you pick up the word. I think you will really quickly. So we're looking at 1 Samuel 18. Verse 5, whatever Saul sent him to do, David did it so successfully that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. Or verse 13, so he, Saul, sent David away from him and gave him command over 1,000 men, and David led the troops in their campaigns. In everything he did, he had great success. Or chapter 18, verse 15, when Saul saw how successful he was afraid of him. Verse 16, reading from the Good News Bible, but it accurately represents the Hebrew. Everyone in Israel and Judah loved David because he was such a successful leader. Or verse 30, the Philistine commanders continued to go out to battle, and as often as they did, David met with more success than the rest of Saul's officers, and his name became well known. Success, 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 successful success. It fills the chapter. And so I want to suggest that the first thing that David encounters, having killed Goliath, is that he becomes hugely successful and moves to a profile in his community that none of us, I would suggest, would ever get even close to. And I wanted just to study the areas in which he became successful. Not that we will. I'm not saying, hey, this will happen to us. I just want us to get a picture of what David was like if he lived in 2012. So first of all, it seems to me he is highly successful professionally. In point of fact, anybody who had eyes to see, and some people did, realized that David is without doubt the next king of Israel. Now David knew that. You remember 1 Samuel 16:1, the Lord said to Samuel, how long will you mourn for Saul, since I've rejected him as king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil, be on your way. I'm sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I have chosen one of his sons to be king. So there we have it stated. In chapter 18, which flows out of chapter 17, you remember when Saul is dialoguing and who's David and all the rest of it, and there's this conversation going on, and one of the people who's listening to the conversation and seeing what David did with Goliath is Jonathan. And Jonathan also was a fighting machine. Jonathan also is an elite soldier. And like attracts like. Monkeys hang out with monkeys. Giraffes swing around with giraffes, etc. Don't swing, but you know what I mean. Like attracts like, and Jonathan's heart knits with David. And it says in chapter 18, verse 4, Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow and his belt. Wow! That was an incredible thing to do. Whatever else it was about, and we'll look at whatever else it might be about in a minute, he is giving David the trappings of royalty. Don't know how many of you are Trekkies. I don't know how many of you like Star Trek. How many of you remember Jean-Luc Picard, captain of the USS Enterprise, with the pips on his shoulders? It's like him stripping off his uniform, his captain's uniform, and giving it to one of the guys on the deck. This was a prophetic sign. Jonathan knows the greatness that he sees in David. Actually, in 23 verse 17... many months, maybe years on, Jonathan meets with David when David's on the run, and Jonathan says to him, don't be afraid, my father Saul will not lay a hand on you, you shall be king over Israel. Even my father Saul knows this. So David is being successful professionally. Notice the promotion that he enjoys in verse 5 of chapter 18. Whatever Saul sent him to do, David did it so successfully that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. With respect, this isn't a corporal or a sergeant major. That's not a high rank. This is the equivalent in our culture of somebody becoming a marine or a colonel or a general. You know, if you'd have seen David on military parade, this guy would have looked like Bruce Willis in one of those films where a general walks up with all the medals and all the gear on. Incredible. One of the youngest high-ranking officers ever in the armies of Israel. I don't know if you've ever met high-ranking officers. There's something about them. I was at Forest Home in America, a Christian holiday center. And there were some Marines there who'd come back from Iraq. And one of those guys was a guy called Kip. And he was 47 years old. And he was a colonel in the US Marines. And this guy was in civvies. But whoa, when I saw this guy, did he look incredible. He looked like he worked out at the gym. He'd been in the Marines since he was 17 years old. 30 years he'd been in the Marine Corps. There was something about him. That's what David looked like. David is put in charge probably of one third of Saul's elite forces. It says in verse 13 of chapter 18, "So he, Saul, sent David away from him, gave him command over 1,000 men, and David led the troops in their campaigns." Now in chapter 13, verse 2, it says, "Saul chose 3,000 men from Israel. 2,000 were with him at Michmash and in the hill country of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah. The rest of the men he sent back home." So it seems as though Saul has 3,000 elite soldiers, and he has them in regiments or whatever you would call it, and it seems as though David is put over a third of the elite forces. Notice, and I know that I thought there might be some young people here, so I've got to be careful with this next bit, but what Saul asked him to do, David did twice as much as what he asked him to do. In verse 25, "Saul replied, 'Say to David, the king wants no other prize for the bride than 100 Philistine foreskins to take revenge on his enemies.'" He wanted to be certain that it is Philistines that he's killed. And the Philistines, of course, the children of Israel referred to as uncircumcised Philistines. So kill 100. And before the allotted time, David and his men come back having killed 200 Philistines. And by the way, soldiers are not particularly thrilled at being separated from their foreskins. So I imagine this wasn't some kind of, you know, little deal. This was a battle, and David does it incredibly well. David becomes recognized wherever he goes in the land. Imagine you couldn't walk anywhere in Great Britain without everybody knowing who you were. That's what it says. It says in verse 30. Of chapter 18, "The Philistine commanders continued to go out to battle, and as often as they did, David met with more success than the rest of Saul's officers, and his name became well known." Different from verse 23. I hope you're following through, because we're looking at the text. We're digging into the text to see what it says. Verse 23, "They repeated these words to David. David said, 'Do you think it's a small matter to become the king's son-in-law? I'm only a poor man and little known.'" That's not true anymore. As the chapter continues and he's more and more successful, this guy looking like Bruce Willis in a film with all the medals on his chest, this guy an elite general in the armies of Israel, this guy known throughout the land, is moving up and up and up and up and up and up professionally. God can do that. God can do that in an instant. So let's imagine, and I'm not in any way minimizing this, but let's imagine your job right now is stacking shelves at Asda. And God does something, and within a few weeks, you are the CEO of a major company and you're driving a Porsche around. That's what happened to David. He goes from being a little shepherd boy to known throughout the land of Israel in days or weeks. And God can do that. So you have a guy in a maximum security wing of a prison in Egypt as a sex offender, Joseph. And within days, he's the equivalent of the Prime Minister of Egypt. God can do that stuff. And he does it for David. He is highly successful professionally. I'm not saying that will happen to us. I'm just trying to get the level at which David is operating. Secondly, David is highly successful relationally. He, for instance, is on the inner track with the prince of that nation. It says in verse 1 of chapter 18, after David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, listen to this, and he loved him as he loved himself. That's incredible. And he gives him this gift. Now we saw that the gifts he gives him, his tunic, his bow, etc., his sword. Yes, this is a prophetic sign that he recognizes that David will step into his shoes. David is going to be the next king of Israel. But it's also a gift. This is very, very intimate gift for one man to give to another man. It's incredible. And the better you know somebody and the more you care about somebody, the more appropriate the gifts you can give them. I don't know if you found that. If it's coming up Christmas and you think, I don't know what to get for such a person, the more you know them and the more you love them, the easier it is to give them something that's right on the target. One of my heroes is a man called George Mallory. And George Mallory was, in my opinion, the first person to successfully climb Everest, providing you don't define that you've got to get back again at the end of it. George Mallory in 1924 was last seen on the final slopes of Everest with a guy called Sandy Irvine. I mean, it's kind of funny when you read it. It's so moving to read the account of their climb. He had a tweed jacket on. He had some woolly gloves on that he bought at the local market. And he and this guy disappeared. Now, in 1999, 75 years later, they found his body frozen into the slopes. And they knew it was him. I mean, there's the little receipt for the gloves that he bought. It's just so moving. There's a can of sardines in his pocket. What wasn't in his pocket was a photograph of his wife, Ruth. And he told all his friends if he ever made it to the top of Everest, he'd leave her photograph on the summit. That's why I think he fell on the way back down. One of my heroes. A few years ago, I got this beautiful, beautiful, beautiful book from my youngest daughter. And it made me cry when I read the inscription on the front cover. The book was called The Ghosts of Everest. And it's looking at the expedition to try and find Mallory's body in 1999. And what my daughter had written on the flyleaf was, to one of my heroes. Fantastic. The more you know somebody, the more appropriate the gift that you give them. And so there's no question about it. David is on the inner track with the prince of the land. He's deep friends, not in a bad way, a sexual way, in a healthy way. Two guys who are elite soldiers and who resonate together. I would suggest that if David was living in 2012, he would have been on all the talk shows. You know, somebody launches a book or something and suddenly they're on this show and that show. Whether you like the shows or not, it isn't particularly important, but they're on the Jonathan Ross show or whatever. And they interview them. David would have been on all the talk shows. It says in verse 5, Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the people and Saul's officers as well. That's fantastic. That's why the Oscars are so great, because the Oscars are not what people generally think about actors and actresses. The Oscars are what actors and directors think about actors. That's why in football, it is the players' player of the year that's so important. And here are elite officers who rate David. He's also, if it's 2012 we're talking about, the guest of honour at a rock concert. Just imagine you two have a rock concert in Hyde Park. And for lyres, read guitars. For flutes, read drums. I mean, think of a modern rock band. Think of Bono heading that up. And when David walks on, everybody stands up and applauds. That's what it says in their culture, verse 6. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, The women came from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul, with singing and with dancing, with joyful songs, with tambourines, lutes. As they danced, they sang this song that went international. It would have been on all the, it would have been on all the radio stations. They knew about it in adjacent nations. They'd heard the song as well, as we know, as we read on in the story. As they danced, they sang, Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. David is this national hero. Verse 16, all Israel and all Judah loved David because he led them in their campaigns. Imagine, big imagine, imagine England won the World Cup at football. Imagine. Imagine that happened in the days of David Beckham. Hero throughout the nation because he won the World Cup at football. Or imagine we absolutely flatten the Aussies at cricket. Captain of the cricket team, hero throughout the nation. Johnny Wilkerson, bang, getting that ball over the rugby final. Hero throughout. This is David. All of Israel and all of Judah loved David because he led them so successfully in the military campaigns. And finally, under this, he marries a princess. You know, put that into our culture. I don't think this was some deal that took place at the Dog and Duck on a rainy Saturday afternoon. He marries Saul's younger daughter, Michal. Fascinating. So you go to the newsstand and there is Hello Magazine. And they've got an exclusive on the marriage between the youngest general ever in the armies of Israel and the princess, daughter of Saul. It would have been all over. It would have been on CNN. It would have been on Sky News. That is David. This guy has moved to a completely different level than we ever dream of moving. Professionally, relationally, and spiritually. I love this. Verse 12. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with David, but had left Saul. Verse 14, in everything he did, he had great success because the Lord was with him. Verse 28, when Saul realized that the Lord was with David. What does that mean? Does that mean that David had a quiet time? Well, yes. Does that mean that David kind of memorized some of the Psalms? Yes. But I would suggest it meant far more than that. I don't know if you've ever met anybody and measurably, observably, tangibly, God is with them. I've met a couple of people like that. There's a shiver goes down your back. When they walk into a room, wow. They are in capital letters, in every meaning of the word, charismatic. There is just a presence, there's an awe about them. But there is also, if they're a Christian, a presence about them. God is tangibly, observably with them. And that's now true of David. It was also true of Samuel. You remember when Samuel showed up, people trembled. When Samuel went to Bethlehem to anoint the next king of Israel, it tells us in 1 Samuel 3, verse 19 and 20, I beg your pardon, chapter 16, verse 4, the elders of the town trembled when they met Samuel. Do you remember when David is on the run? Chapter 21, verse 1, he goes to Nob to Ahimelech the priest. Ahimelech trembled when he met him. So we're not exaggerating to say that the word that we can write across David is success. Out of any league that anybody here, I would suggest, is ever going to arrive at. It's as though God says, okay, I'm going to put this guy up so many levels, now you can learn what goes with success. It also begins with S, and it's called suffering. If I want to move on with God, if I want to step up a level, this is part of the deal. Not it might happen, it will happen. David is surrounded by enemies now. First of all, the enemy all around him. Who were the enemy all around David? Well, they're mentioned 127 times in 1 and 2 Samuel. The enemy all around David, who are targeting David, it is quite literally as though David has got a target on his back. And whenever he goes into battle, All the enemy soldiers who want to make a name for themselves are looking for the target. That's literally what the text says later on. Are the Philistines. And Saul saying, I won't kill him. I'll let the Philistines do that. I'll make him my son-in-law. So, chapter 17, verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered their forces for war. 17, verse 4. A champion named Goliath came out of the Philistine camp. Chapter 18, verse 17. Saul says, I'll not raise a hand against him. Let the Philistines do that. Chapter 19, verse 8. Once more war broke out and David went to fight the Philistines. Chapter 28, verse 4. The Philistines says, and on and on and on and on and on it goes. David is now again and again and again face to face with the Philistines. Who are the Philistines? The Philistines are an ancient enemy of God's people who lived on the coastal strip, listen to this, and who resisted passionately any attempt of God's people to move forward. Whenever God's people, in response to God, try to move on, bang, the Philistines come against them. Whenever God's people gain some territory, it's not too long before the Philistines come back again. I am certain that you know about that in your life. One of the reasons I personally, and I know some of you will love this, so forgive me. One of the reasons I personally hate gardening is because the flipping weeds don't stop growing. You know, you work so hard to get something sorted out and within days or weeks, they're back again. Just like the Philistines, who won't go away. And I wonder what the areas are in your life that you know about when you try and move on with God and advance. This keeps coming back again and saying, thought you beat me. Okay, let me show you. David has an enemy all around him. David also has an enemy alongside him. If the Philistines are mentioned 127 times in 1 and 2 Samuel, this enemy is mentioned 307 times. By far the biggest enemy in Saul's life when he moves up to this new level is Saul. Saul hates David with a passion. It's interesting to track Saul's attitude to David. Maybe just do it sometime. Maybe just read through 1 Samuel. Chapter 17, 55. As Saul watched David going out to meet the Philistine, he said to Abner, commander of the army, Abner, whose son is that young man? Abner replied, as surely as you live, O king, I don't know. So Saul is intrigued. Who is this guy? Chapter 18, verse 6. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistines, all these women come out with all the musical instruments singing and stuff. Saul has slain his thousands. David his tens of thousands. Saul was very angry. This refrain galled him. They've credited David with tens of thousands, he thought, but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom? And from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. Chapter 18, verse 29. Saul became still more afraid of him and remained his enemy for the rest of his life. Samuel 1 Samuel 19:10. We're going to look at this tonight. Saul tried to pin him to the wall with a spear. Hey, you know what? In our language, this is a brother or sister Christian. Hello? This ain't the Philistines. This isn't the world out there. These are my supposed fellow members of the children of people of God in here. It is Saul who's trying to kill David. The guy who's supposed to be reflecting the kingdom and character of God. We saw this last week. Who are the people who get so angry with him? His brothers. When he's saying, let me just be clear on what Saul's going to give to the guy who takes out Goliath. And his brothers get so angry at him. I don't have to major on this, I'm sure you know this. Some of our biggest battles are not with pagans out there, but with brothers and sisters who are supposed to be on the same team. And then finally, if there's an enemy around him and there's an enemy alongside him, there's another enemy. The Philistines are mentioned 127 times. Saul is mentioned 307 times. This enemy is mentioned 471 times. And his name is David. One of the biggest battles David has is with David. With stuff in David. A man after God's own heart. Who does all kinds of crazy stuff. I mean, when you track it, it's almost unbelievable if it wasn't in the Bible what he does. You know, David goes with the Philistines and marches into Israel in the Philistine army. Because he's been living a lie for years, certainly 18 months. He's gone over to the Philistines. He goes over a couple of times. And one time he's got spit running down the side of his face and he's doodling on the city gates as though he's a madman. And the Philistines think, hey, fantastic, let's get this guy on our side. David, when he's living the lie, is slaughtering people so they won't blow the whistle on him when he's living with... He does all kinds of stuff. You know the whole Bathsheba incident? I mean, it's incredible. We look at Saul. David takes a contract out on Uriah. Having slept with this guy's wife and she gets pregnant, he then writes a little note that Uriah carries in his back pocket and takes back to the commander of the armies of Israel, which says, get Uriah killed, written by David. There's all kinds of stuff inside David, which isn't that brilliant. Just like, you know, there's all kinds of stuff in you when you take the Sunday mask off that you fight with in an ongoing way. Hey, welcome to the team. Welcome to the club. What's it like to move on with God? It's to encounter real enemies. Wanted to end. I promise you 2 minutes left. I know I told you this story before, but I just want to end with it. One day, Michael Caine, as a young film actor, was supposed to be filming a scene where he walks into a room. So they have the films rolling, the days when they use celluloid film, so it costs a lot. He throws the door open, he walks into the room, and somebody has left by mistake an overturned chair in the entrance to the room. And so he goes out of character and says, whoa, stop filming. And the guys come along, they get the scene the way it should be, and then they film that particular part of the story. Later that day, the director, who was a much older man, came to Michael and said to him, why did you stop filming? And he said, well, because, you know, this shouldn't have happened, and there it is in front of me. And Michael Caine said the director said something to him that not only changed his take on acting, but changed his take on life. The director said to him, Michael, use the difficulties when you're filming. He said, if we'd have been filming a farce, yes, the chair shouldn't have been there, but you could have tripped over it and kept on filming. If we, as we were, filming a thriller, you could have picked the chair up and hurled it out of the way and gone into the room. Michael used the difficulties. And I want to suggest that that's what David does. Listen to Psalm 23. Middle of Psalm 23, written by David, as we close. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil because you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. What's a table? A table is a place where there's food. What happens when you eat food? You grow. Where is the place that David says to God, this is what's grown me? Listen to what he says. In the valleys, in the shadows, in the threat of death. Where there is evil, where there is the potential to fear, where there are enemies, that's how you grow me. So if we want to move on with God to another level, guess what? For every new level, there is a new devil. For every new level of serving God, we will encounter, I don't mean necessarily demons and evil spirits, just kind of put it in our mind so we remember it. I mean problems, opposition, challenges, difficulties. So here's what I want you to take into this week, if all you're able to come to is this morning. I want you to identify the problems in your life, whether they are personal, whether they are relational, whether they are in the area of seeking to do what God is telling you to do and it doesn't seem to be working out. I want you to identify the problems. And I want you to dare to believe it's in those that God is seeking to turn a boy into a king. It's in those that God is seeking to develop me and grow me as I walk with him in the middle of the problems. Now tonight we're going to ask, so do I do that on my own, or does God send me help in the middle of the problems? And the answer is, he sends you help. Don't miss this. But most Christians don't really understand how God sends help to us when we're in the middle of a problem. And we're going to look at chapter 19. You might like to read it on your own. I think you might be staggered at the kind of people God uses to send help to David in the nightmare that's unfolding. And tonight I'll be closing by asking, are you willing to accept help from people like that if God chooses to use them? Let's pray together, and then I'm going to hand back to the band. Father, thank you for your word, which is so real to life and so true actually to our own experience. Thank you that it reminds us again that you're for us, you're with us, but the road is tough. And I pray, Lord, especially for those here who are wounded or hurting, that you'd take something from your truth this morning and plant it in their heart and nourish them through it and encourage them. And I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.